Well, good evening, everyone. The talk this evening is going to be on mudita, the third Brahma Vihara, which I selected for my talk. Mudita is happiness for another's happiness, or joy for another's joy, or another's good fortune, in contradistinction maybe of jealousy. And I think one of the reasons in retrospect that I asked for this talk to be mine is because I'm the envy type in the Enneagram. In case any of you know the Enneagram, there's 9 personality types. Well, I'm the envy type. That I'm trying to, work with. And the opposite of mudita is envy. So anyway, so this is a good topic for me to talk about. So I want to talk about mudita, and I want to just sort of step back for a second too and talk about how the Brahma Viharas fit in the Buddhist scheme. Because, we call this a Brahma Vihara retreat as opposed to an insight retreat. How do the Brahma Viharas fit into the whole scheme? So I thought I would do both. But first I wanted to address a couple of notes I got. I thought maybe it might be beneficial to answer it in front of the whole group in case others had similar questions. And also I wanted to just mention that some of the talks are going to be recorded. So that might be ease your mind to know. And I guess Glenn may have more information about that at the end of the retreat. All right, so one note I got was, if the totality of experience is the 6 senses, what about the jhana states, or these 8 altered states of consciousness that are taught, that I teach and others teach? And those are mental states. They're products of the mind sense door. So that's where they fit into the 6 senses. Another question is, you recommended a book, but I didn't get the title. It was Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. It's all about the Brahma Viharas. And then this came up in an interview today, but I thought others might be interested. We were talking about striving versus wholesome aspiration. And the person, couldn't remember the words I gave for the wholesome part, but that's it. Wholesome aspirations versus, constricted striving. So, which can be unwholesome. So, wanting to be enlightened is said to be a wholesome aspiration, right up until the point you start striving for it. White knuckled. All right. Ruth talked the other night about loving kindness, and Shell's talked about compassion. I'll talk about equanimity, and then Ruth is going to talk again about... I'm going to talk about mudita, and Ruth is going to talk tomorrow about equanimity. And we've been talking about the boundless nature of these qualities of mind, these wholesome qualities of mind. And where that word boundless comes from is in the suttas, in the Kalama Sutta, which is a quite famous sutta. And in it, the Buddha talks about these 4 wholesome states of mind as being boundless. And he talks about dwelling, having pervaded with the thought of loving kindness, one quarter of our space that we can imagine. Likewise, the second quarter of the space we can imagine. Likewise, the third quarter of the space. Likewise, the fourth. And so above, and so below, and across, one dwells, having pervaded thus, because of the existence in it of all living beings everywhere, the entire world, with the great, exalted, boundless thought of loving kindness that is free of hate or malice. That's pretty boundless. And he goes on to repeat that same thing for thoughts of compassion, thoughts of mudita, and thoughts of equanimity. So these Brahmaviharas are wholesome mind states. And once perfected, they become boundless, without impediment. And the way that I like to think about them is that loving kindness is sort of the ground floor of the Brahmaviharas, from which the others sprang, really. Loving kindness is unconditional love towards oneself and others for absolutely no reason. And once perfected, it's boundless in all directions. And then compassion is metta, loving kindness, in response to suffering. So you have to have the experience already of knowing how to have loving kindness in your heart before you can have compassion, because compassion is the extension of loving kindness towards suffering, whether it's mine or yours, whether it's ours or another's. And just the same, mudita is loving kindness in response, not to another's suffering, but to another's good fortune. But you have to know, you have to have loving kindness in your heart to be able to extend mudita to another for their good fortune, because it's the extension of loving kindness in response to good fortune that is mudita. And it's not just to another's good fortune, by the way. We can also have self-mudita. We can be happy for our own good fortune. And then finally, equanimity is the balanced response to both suffering and happiness. The 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows that Ruth will talk more about. So mudita, just like compassion is the loving heart's response to suffering, mudita is the loving heart's response to oneself's or another's good fortune. And I like to use the word mudita instead of the English translation of sympathetic joy or altruistic joy, because for me those don't really get at what it is, the happiness for another's happiness. I mean, they're nice phrases, altruistic joy or sympathetic joy, but I just prefer the word mudita. I like it. It's sort of a nice word. And I know what it means. It's like a dukkha sort of better describes suffering than the word suffering does. Because suffering isn't really an accurate translation. So, and Shel was talking about that. So I'll go with the word mudita. But I want to back up for a minute and talk about how the Brahmaviharas fit into the Buddhist scheme of suffering and no suffering. You know, the Buddha said he taught those two things, and those two things only. The truth of suffering and the truth to the end of suffering. And he laid out the Four Noble Truths as a roadmap for achieving liberation from suffering. And the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. You know, the truth of suffering exists, even in the good stuff. It can exist because it's temporary. The good stuff is going to disappear. So there's suffering potential in that if we're attached. And there's suffering in the stuff we don't like, potentially, if we have aversion to it. So that's the first noble truth, to understand the truth of suffering. And the second noble truth is to understand the cause of suffering, which he described as craving for things to be different than the way they are. Doesn't mean that we can't work to change things, but if we do it from a place of craving, you know, we're going to be suffering along the way and possibly making others suffer. So we want to change things from a place of wisdom, of accepting first the way things are, and then moving from that place of wisdom if we want to change things. And the third noble truth is that there's an end to suffering, which is that very letting go of craving and understanding how that suffering occurs in the scheme of things and sort of the role of the teaching on dependent origination, the teaching that says that, you know, what I was talking about earlier today with regard to Vedana, that if we can just be with the initial categorization of sensory input, which is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, instead of letting it bloom all the way into greed or aversion, we can get off this wheel of samsara, of suffering. Stop the craving for things to be different than the way they are. So that's the third noble truth. And the fourth noble truth is the path that he taught that would get us there. It's an eightfold path that if we traverse, we will, you know, have the possibility of becoming awake from this cyclical suffering that goes on almost moment to moment. Almost moment to moment. Craving for things to be different than the way they are. Having thoughts of greed and aversion. Almost moment to moment. Letting pleasant Vedana turn into greed and unpleasant Vedana turn into aversion. Almost with on a moment-to-moment basis. So this noble eightfold path is to be developed, because it's one thing to say, "Oh, just let go of craving." It's another thing to do it, right? And so that's why the path is here. The path is a path of practice for learning how to let go of craving. And it's got a wisdom component, an ethics component, and a concentration component that includes mindfulness. So we're working this Noble Eightfold Path this week, and embedded in this Noble Eightfold Path are the Brahmaviharas. And that's the point I'm wanting to make. That's the Brahmaviharas that we're practicing and learning are part of the Noble Eightfold Path that gets us to the end of suffering. That's how they fit in, and I'll be a little bit more specific here. In the wisdom factors on the Noble Eightfold Path, it's the first and second factors. There's eight factors. But in the wisdom component, there's right view and right thought. And right view is the view about karma, which is that there are consequences to our actions. So understanding that view and living accordingly. So there's thought, there's consequences to our intentional thoughts, intentional words, and our intentional actions. That's the first factor on this Noble Eightfold Path. And the second factor is right thought. And this is one of the factors where the Brahmaviharas come into play. The Brahmaviharas come into play in three different factors. And this is the first factor I'll talk about because it's right thought. And to perfect the path to awakening, we need to develop the right thought of renunciation, non-ill will, and harmlessness. And the way to non-ill will is generating thoughts of loving kindness and thoughts of mudita and thoughts of equanimity. So right here in the second factor of right thought is developing the Brahmaviharas. So you can almost check this one off after this week retreat. All right, so those are the wisdom factors. On to the ethics factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And right speech is speech that's truthful, useful, timely, and kind. And as a shortcut, I like to talk about King Tut, who was a mummy and didn't talk. And if you practice right speech, you practically can't talk. But T for Tut, the first T is truthful. Not half-truths. Truthful. Truthful speech. Useful is the U in King Tut. Not gossip. You might need to talk about sports to connect with somebody. It might be useful in that way. Or the weather. It might be useful to connect in a little bit of idle chatter. But, you know, useful. Useful speech. And T for timely. Timely speech. Don't talk when I'm angry. Don't talk when the other person's too tired to listen. Or they're angry. So timely speech. And then the K in King is for kind. King Tut. Now, the Buddha wasn't a people pleaser. So, you know, he would say things that were disagreeable. As long as they were truthful and useful, and what he had to say was typically both, and he'd say disagreeable things if it was timely. If the listener was in a place where they could hear it. Not tired, not sick, not angry. But he didn't shy away from being disagreeable. In a kind way. So that's right speech, the third factor of eight. Right action is the fourth factor of eight, and here's again where the Brahmaviharas come in to play. Right action is nothing other than the five precepts we talked about the first night. Refrain from killing living beings, taking that which is not freely offered, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false speech, and refraining from intoxicants that cloud the mind. And remember when I was talking about the higher and higher forms of these precepts? Well, for the precept of refraining from killing beings, the next higher form of that precept was not harming living beings. So it's not only not killing them, but not harming them. And the highest form of not killing living beings is extending loving kindness to all living beings. So that's where metta comes in. And the fourth factor along the eightfold path, which is right action. So these Brahmaviharas are embedded in the Noble Eightfold Path. And then the fifth factor along the Noble Eightfold Path that you'll want to develop if you want to awaken from your suffering is right livelihood, which is really just not engaging in livelihood that violates one of the five precepts or causes another to. So don't be employed in mercenary killings, or maybe even selling liquor, or whatever else might violate. I could have a field day with this, but I got to get to mudita. So that's right livelihood, the fifth factor. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. When I first heard all these eight factors years ago, I was kind of blown away by them all. Year after year, I think, oh, I think I might be doing that one. Oh, that one. So I never got tired of hearing about them and plotting my progress along the course of developing them. So right speech, right action, and right livelihood are the three ethics factors. And the final three factors are the concentration factors. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration fall into right concentration, or in the concentration factors. So right effort is abandoning unwholesome states of mind and encouraging wholesome ones. What are wholesome states of mind? The Brahmaviharas. All four of them. Metta, Karuna, Mudita, and Upekkha. Right effort, abandoning the unwholesome mind states of greed, hatred, and delusion, and cultivating the wholesome ones, loving kindness, compassion, mudita, and equanimity. So that's the third of the three factors where the Brahmaviharas are embedded. And there's two more I want to talk about. Right mindfulness is the next one, which we've been also practicing this week. That's mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, initial sensory input, categorization of input. So mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, which is Vedana, they call it. Mindfulness of mind states, that's mindfulness of greed, hatred, and delusion, and mindfulness of the Buddha's teachings, including the six sense gates. So you've been practicing that. So you can practically check this one off too. There's a little more to it than I just described. And then the eighth of the Noble Eightfold Path is right concentration. It includes the jhanas, but it's when you can get free of sense desires and unwholesome states of mind and have a very stable mind. When your mind is indistractable. So come on retreat with me at a jhana retreat and I'll teach you the jhanas. But short of that, you can also get a concentrated mind on your own. It takes a lot of practice, though. All right, so those are the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth, which leads to the end of suffering. And it's said that all of these eight factors in the Noble Eightfold Path need to be perfected to achieve the first stage of enlightenment. So Brahmaviharas are crucial. On the path to awakening. Crucial. All right, so mudita. Happiness for another's happiness. It has practice phrases too. You know, like metta has maybe be happy, safe, healthy, and live with ease. Mudita has two phrases. It's, may my happiness continue, or may your happiness continue. That's the first one. The second one is, may my happiness grow. May your happiness grow. So may it not only continue as it is, but may it grow. And we can practice mudita off the cushion, of course, and on the cushion. One of my favorite examples of mudita off the cushion comes from a movie, one of my favorite movies called Love Actually. It's a Hugh Grant film that came out, you know, I don't know, 15 years ago maybe now. Has it been that long? So, but at the very first scene of the movie is at Heathrow Airport, and it's a real shot at Heathrow of people greeting each other coming off the planes. It was right around 9/11, because there's a little clip in the narration of the beginning of the film talking about when the phone calls were made from the planes on 9/11. They probably weren't calls of hatred, but they were probably calls of loving love. But anyway, in this scene at Heathrow, the camera just zooms in on these reunited people, one coming off of a plane and the other coming to meet them in the airport, and the hugs and the smiles and the greeting and the sheer joy that they're experiencing of being together. And the mudita is not between them so much as it is in the viewer of them, the observer of them. The camera is capturing their happiness, and the viewer has got a big smile on her face watching the happiness of these people being reunited. Grandmothers with grandchildren. Lovers, you know. Women lovers and men lovers and women and men lovers and old men and young men and sisters and brothers. Friends. And it's just beautiful to watch. That's mudita, happiness for another's happiness. So you can experience it off the cushion at an airport, just watching. Or, you know, when you hear of another's good fortune through the grapevine. or when you see another's happiness, or even a dog wagging its tail because he's happy to be walked. You can have mudita for the puppy dog. Or my kitty cats, Lucy and Desi, when they're purring, you know. Just gives me such joy for them. When we see a child laughing, oh my gosh. A teenager happy to get their first iPhone. Happiness for another's happiness, mudita. When a partner receives an accolade. All right, so I wonder if you can imagine someone who's had good fortune lately or in their lives. It may be you. I know for me, I just retired from years of government service in February, and I am living the life of Riley. I got a nice little cabin in the mountains of North Carolina, and me and my cat sit on my front porch and look at the Smoky Mountains. It's really sweet. I feel so fortunate. May my happiness continue. May it grow. So, who's on your radar? It might be you. It might be someone else. But why don't we close our eyes for a moment and just practice a little mudita? It could be for a purring kitty cat. Doesn't matter. We'll just kind of close our eyes for a minute and bring to our mind ourself or someone we know who's doing well. And just say a little prayer of mudita. May your happiness continue. Or may my happiness continue. From the place, from the heart, you know. May your happiness grow. May my happiness grow. From the loving heart space, may your happiness continue. May your happiness grow. So that's the loving heart's response to good fortune. There's a joyousness in that, isn't there? I can see why they call it sympathetic joy or altruistic joy. There is a joy to it. It's a happiness. Said that the near enemy to mudita is manic exuberance. So like rioting in the street after a ball game. And the far enemy is resentment, although I don't think it's that far. It's also said that mudita is the most difficult of the Brahma Viharas. It's kind of curious. The most difficult. But it's because there are so many impediments to it, like envy and jealousy. And in Sharon Salzberg's book on loving kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness, she talks about 6 or 7 impediments to mudita. I'll talk about 3 tonight. But there's more to be said on it. But she talks about the comparing mind being an impediment to mudita. And prejudice against people we don't like, and scarcity thinking. So those are 3 impediments to mudita, and I'll go into a little bit into each one. Comparing mind, which, by the way, is the last to go before we become fully enlightened. So get used to it. It's going to be here. Don't try to beat it away, but just, you know, kind of get a sense of humor about it. Ah, well, yes. The Tibetans have a great prayer. It goes something like this. May we be free of thoughts of superiority. May we be free of thoughts of inferiority. And may we be free of thoughts of equality. What does that leave us with? That's the point. So comparing mind is an impediment to mudita. You know, if I'm feeling superior to someone who has good fortune, how dare they have good fortune? I should be having it. They're not good enough for that. They're going beyond their means to get that new car. They don't resemble that. Or if someone superior, I think, to me, has good fortune. Oh, not that again. They get that notoriety? That is so unfair. Yeah. She doesn't deserve all that. Or someone equal to me that I think is equal to me. Oh, I could have done that. I could have done it. So comparing mind, an impediment to mudita. When somebody superior than us, we think, or inferior than us, we think, or equal to us, we think, has good fortune, it robs us of the ability to practice mudita, which is a necessary, wholesome mind state to develop along the path of freedom. So look for opportunities to practice it. And look for the impediments that keep us from practicing it. So comparing mind is one of them. A second one is prejudice against people we don't like. So what happens when somebody we don't like has good fortune? You know, it might be easier to have goodwill towards people we do like. But if our willingness to have goodwill is only towards people we do like, it's a powerful impediment to developing mudita. Crossing that line from people we like to people we dislike can be very difficult when they have good fortune. People we don't like have good fortune. But it's through compassion for people we don't like, that we begin to extend mudita beyond our prejudices. compassion reminds us that indeed everyone suffers. And everyone deserves good fortune. As Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said, if we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm our hostility. So can we have mudita for those we don't like? When they have good fortune. And then finally, scarcity thinking. You know, when we think happiness is a limited resource or commodity, the more that someone else might get, the less there is for us. And I have a rather embarrassing example of this. But I used to be a federal prosecutor years ago. I got over that, but I did. And I tried jury cases. I prosecuted violent crime and drugs. And it was a very competitive environment. And I was the only woman prosecutor in my office in Tennessee. And all the other prosecutors were men, and they were gung-ho, and they didn't much like me, and I didn't much like them. But I did good for some reason. I don't know. Juries convicted my defendants in 12 minutes or less. Men in my office just did not like that. But towards the end of my career, I had defendants and their wives and their lawyers thanking me for treating their clients with dignity. So it was during a time towards the end of my career when I was meditating and treating defendants, as human beings and thinking, but for the grace of God, there go I. But it took me a while to get there. But anyway, during the middle of this whole tenure as a prosecutor, I remember, I was not conscious of this at the time, only later as a meditator when I reflected back on it, but I remembered it clearly, that my colleague, a man, was waiting for a jury to come back on a case he just tried, a big criminal case, waiting for the jury's verdict, hoping for a guilty verdict. And, he's my colleague. He worked down the hall from me. He was up against a big defense lawyer, and, the defense lawyer, of course, was hoping for an innocent verdict. But, he was in his office across the street, and my colleague was right down the hall from me, and we were all kind of waiting for the verdict. And secretly, I was hoping he would lose. I really was. I was on the same side as him, and I wanted him to lose. I did not want him to have a victory. I didn't care if his client was guilty of sin and walked the streets the next day. I wanted him to lose. Because if he won, there was just so much good stuff in the pie. If he got it, there'd be less for me. Now, I didn't, know all this at the time, but boy, when I heard about mudita, I know what that is. I know what it's not. I know exactly what mudita is not. Yeah. It's the scarcity thinking is an impediment to mudita. it's the hardest Brahma-vihara to develop, mudita. And these impediments are rooted in greed and hatred and delusion. But as we develop mudita, the happiness of others becomes our happiness. Right? Happiness for another's happiness, or happiness for our own happiness. Another's happiness becomes our happiness. The happiness of another's happiness is not going to take away from ours, even if the happiness of the other is happiness of an enemy. Ultimately, our happiness and that of another is inseparable. So I talked a little earlier about Ayakema's prescription of recognizing unwholesome thoughts, not blaming the trigger, and substituting wholesome thoughts for unwholesome thoughts. And that applies with mudita as well. Recognize when you're in an unwholesome thought, mind state of scarcity thinking, like I was, or jealousy, or not liking someone who has good fortune, or comparing mind. You know, just recognize when you're in that unwholesome mind state, and don't blame that person. The responsibility for your mind state lies in your mind. And then substitute mudita when another has good fortune. So may our happiness continue. May our happiness grow. And may the happiness of others continue. And may the happiness of others grow. Can we just sit for a moment?